All right. Did everybody get a chance to read some of the background material that I gave you? It'll be kind of important as we start to dig into Jeremiah from now on. The readings in Kings and Chronicles that I gave you in the introductory handout, they're kind of important, and we'll be adding a little bit more of Kings and Chronicles as we go along. Especially tonight, we'll be looking at some of the things that happened prior to Jeremiah and prior to Josiah becoming king, because they have a direct bearing on the things that we're going to be talking about tonight. So tonight we're going to be covering, starting with chapter 2, verse 1, and we'll be going through chapter 4, verse 4, and this is the case against Judah. This is God declaring to Jeremiah and telling Jeremiah to tell the people of Judah how they've gone so wrong and to remind them that there's still a chance. Now, we know that after the reign of Manasseh, and we will see that later on in Jeremiah, that there was no chance that Judah wasn't going into captivity. But had Judah turned their hearts to God, it may not have happened at the time that it did. God may have put that off, but God, knowing that only through experience do humans tend to learn, God knew that it was going to be an effort to get Judah to turn their heart from what they were doing. So we'll get into it. Let's see. So chapter 2 begins with us being introduced to what Judah was. So basically, chapter 1 introduced us to Jeremiah's calling, and we went through that. And my first question to you is, what timestamp is given to us in chapter 1 about when Jeremiah started to prophesy? We had a specific timestamp that we knew exactly when it was. We can place Jeremiah's calling and his prophetical mission not only in Israel's time, but also in time based on historical documents from other kingdoms. So, I see it says chapter. It should be chapter 1 introduced us to his calling. So what is that timestamp, if anybody can recall? And like I said before, if you don't answer, we're going to have a lot of silence.
Is it verse 3?
It's not in chapter 2, it's in chapter 1. So there was basically chapter 1 opens up giving us a timestamp. And what was that?
The 13th year of the reign of Josiah.
There we are, the 13th year of the reign of Josiah. And so the question there is, how does this compare to the readings that I gave you in 2 Kings 22 and verse 3 and 2 Chronicles 34 verses 1 through 8? And I put this chart back up on the screen for you so you could have just an idea of what's going on here and the years that are associated with what we're reading. If you look at the top of the chart here, you see that Josiah's reign was from 629 to 608 BC. So he reigned for 31 years. And we know that he started his reign when he was 8 years old. We can see, we know those years, not because they're told us in the Bible, but because we are given specific years about specific other non-Israeli kings, like in Assyria or Egypt or Babylon, And when we're given like the 13th year of Nebuchadnezzar or something like that, well, from historical digs, we know and can date exactly when that was. And when we're told a date that we can verify historically, then what that does is that gives us the ability to put all of the kingdom of Israel in context in time that we can understand based on history that we have that we can go dig up out of the ground. So even though our years, the way we keep time, AD and BC, isn't how it was kept in the Bible, we can associate those timelines together. And so on this chart, you can see that this first chapter is starting in the 13th reign of Josiah. So that being the case, 626 is when Jeremiah started to prophesy. That's chapter 1, and it's going to be chapters 2 through 6 is during that year. So that gives us a really good way to tell what was going on during that year. We can, if you look to the right of the chart at the top there, it gives you some specific things that were happening between 628 and 626, and that was the Scythian raids. So even though we know that Judah didn't fall, Judah was being harassed. Cities were being destroyed. And villages were being conquered by outside powers. So we're already seeing Judah in a downhill spiral, a downward spiral, because of their unfaithfulness to God. So, like I said, we know that, as Dean told us, Jeremiah was called in the 13th year of Josiah's reign. He was called in 626 BC. And so how does that compare to our readings in 2 Kings 22:3 and 2 Chronicles 34, verses 1 through 8? So let's look at that for a second. Josiah was on the scene for 13 years as king from the age of 8. So that puts him at about 21 years old when Jeremiah started prophesying. And if you look at 2 Kings chapter 22 and verse 3, that gives you the timeline of Josiah's 18th year of reign. Let me grab my Bible here real quick. I'm going to pull up Second Chronicles chapter 34 here real quick, just to make sure that what I'm saying is what I remember, because my recall may not be very good. And so if you look in 2 Chronicles chapter 34, and starting at verse 2, I think, Josiah did right in the sight of the Lord and walked in the ways of his father David and did not turn aside to the right or the left. If you just a second here, my earphone just died. Put my other one in. All right, can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, and then if we look at verse 3, it says, "For in the 18th year of his reign, while he was still a youth, he began to seek the God of his father David. And in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah." I'm sorry, did I say 8th? I said 18th. I meant in the 8th year of his reign, while he was still a youth, he began to seek the God of his father David. And in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places and Asherim, the carved images and the molten images. And it goes on to tell us exactly all the things he did. So we see that 5 years before God called Jeremiah, we have a good king who is doing what?
Turning back to God.
Exactly, turning back to God. And not only is he turning back to God, he's turning the people back to God. He's taking away their ability to worship idols. He's taking away the filthiness that has contaminated and polluted the land. And so we see Josiah is fulfilling a mission that Jeremiah is sent to try to also help happen. So as good as Josiah was, for 5 years before Jeremiah came on the scene, Josiah has been doing these good deeds, bringing the people back towards righteousness. He's been taking care of these issues. And so you kind of think in your mind, you say, huh, I wonder why God needed to send Jeremiah. Well, what does that tell you about what was happening in the land at that time? About how bad Judah had become? About the evil that had polluted the land? And about how sinful the people had become? It tells you that five years of Josiah turning the people around as their king wasn't enough to change their hearts back to God. Josiah doing everything he could to make it very difficult to worship idols wasn't turning the people back to God. And even the book of the law coming out wasn't enough to turn the people back to God. And so Jeremiah was called to be a voice for God, to encourage them to continue to follow in his ways, to follow the book of the law, to do everything that was contained in it. Because not only did the book of the law contain blessings, but the book of the law contained curses. And the people were just about to find out how bad those curses could be. So what Judah was, we're going to continue this idea, and we're going to do a little stroll down memory lane based on us living at that time. So Manasseh was the worst of the worst kings in Judah, and his son Amon was a close second. If you look at the chart that I gave you guys, you'll see that if Manasseh could have been a deeper color of red on that scale, he would have been worse than Jehoiakim, worse than Ammon, and worse than Ahaz, because he was the worst. He introduced things into Judah that were not done in other countries, that had not been done in that land since God destroyed the Canaanites that were worshiping, whose evil had come to fruition, and God told Israel to utterly wipe them out. And Manasseh, we're going to read a little bit of this history. These aren't in the readings that I gave you. They're a little bit before the readings I gave you, because this is before Josiah's time. So if you want to look at 2 Chronicles chapter 33, we're going to read verses 4 through 9, and I'd love to have a volunteer to read that.
I'm supposed to.
Okay, tell them again.
Second Chronicles chapter 33, verses 4 through 9.
4 through 9, okay.
Yeah.
He also built altars in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, "In Jerusalem shall my name be forever." And he built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. Also, he caused his sons to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. He practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft and sorcery, and consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image, the idol which he had made, in the house of God, of which God had said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever, and I will not again remove the foot of Israel from the land which I have appointed for your fathers. Only if they are careful to do all that I have commanded them, according to the whole law and the statutes and the ordinances by the hand of Moses. So Manasseh seduced Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel.
All right. So that gives us an idea of how bad Manasseh really was. We know that the Canaanites were wiped out of this land because they were absolutely unsavable. They had gone as far evil as they possibly could. And Manasseh misled Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations whom the Lord destroyed before the sons of Israel. That's how bad Manasseh was. And Manasseh provoked God to anger, to utter wrath.
Ted?
Yes.
The people of Judah at this particular time had Manasseh rule for 55 years.
Mm-hmm.
For a long, long time. And up until the last couple of years of his reign, you were right, he was vicious in his pursuit of evil. But he repented of all that. The last couple of years of his reign, he was very repentant. But I think it was a little bit too late.
And Ron, I'm glad great minds think alike, because look at this. We're going to look at that here in just a second. Ron, since you're talking, I'll have you read it for me.
What would you like me to read?
So, 2 Chronicles chapter 33, we're going to look at verses 10 through 20.
Okay.
So just a few verses after what they finished off with.
All right. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they paid no attention. Therefore, the Lord brought the commanders of the army of the king of Assyria against them, and they captured Manasseh with hooks, bound him with bronze chains, and took him to Babylon. When he was in distress, he entreated the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. When he prayed to him, he was moved by his entreaty and heard his supplication and brought him again to Jerusalem to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord was God. Now after this, he built the outer wall of the city of David on the west side of Gihon in the valley, even to the entrance of the fish gate. And he encircled the Ophel with it and made it very high. Then he put army commanders in all the fortified cities of Judah. He also removed the foreign gods and the idol from the house of the Lord, as well as all the altars which he had built on the mountain of the house of the Lord and in Jerusalem, and he threw them outside the city. He set up the altar of the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings and thank offerings on it. And he ordered Judah to serve the Lord God of Israel. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed in the high places, although only to the Lord their God. Now the rest of the acts of Manasseh, even his prayer to his God, and the words of the seers who spoke to him in the name of the Lord God of Israel, behold, they are among the records of the kings of Israel. His prayer also, and how God was entreated by him, and all his sin, his unfaithfulness, and the sites on which he built high places and erected the Asherim and the carved images before he humbled himself, behold, they are written in the records of the Hosea. So Manasseh slept with his fathers, and they buried him in his own house, and Amon, his son, became king in his place.
All right. So I wanted us to see that he was the worst of the worst, but even he, after he had been exposed to captivity, just for a short time, he was led away with fish hooks through his cheek and his nose and in bronze chains. And even the worst of the worst could be convinced to change his heart after he had been exposed to the cruelty and the barbarism that was the Assyrian kingdom. So Manasseh's repentance had an impact. Look how the people recognized and rebelled against the son of Ammon, the sin of Ammon, that is the son of Manasseh, who became the king in his place. Let's read that. 2 Chronicles chapter 33, and we're going to read verses 21 through 25. Who would like to read that?
Ted, I'll go ahead and read.
All right, go for it, Mark.
21 through 25?
Yeah, 2 Chronicles 33, 21 through 25.
Okay. Ammon's reign and death. Ammon was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 2 years in Jerusalem. But he did evil in the sight of the Lord, as his father Manasseh had done. For Ammon sacrificed to all the carved images which his father Manasseh had made, and served them, and he did not humble himself before the Lord. And his father Manasseh had humbled himself, but Ammon trespassed more and more. Then his servants conspired against him and killed him in his own house. But the people of the land executed all those who had conspired against King Ammon. Then the people of the land made his son Josiah king in his place.
All right. So the worst of the worst had a son who was in his own image. We see that Manasseh repented, but he did not raise his son properly. He had taught his son to bow down to these idols, to offer to them, to worship them. And when he learned his lesson, his son Ammon did not. When he came back, he did not take the proper amount of time that he should have to teach Ammon the horrible things that would befall him. And the only reason that Ammon didn't reign longer than he did is because the people of the land, firstly, the servants in his kingdom, recognized that obviously Manasseh had learned something and had been through something that was horrible, and they didn't want to have any part of what led Manasseh to be carried away by the Assyrians. And so when they saw Ammon heading down that road, they killed him. And after he was dead, the people of the land made Josiah, that was Ammon's son, king in his place. And Josiah's reign started when he was 8 years old. So what we see from this is what Judah was. We see that Judah was steeped in sin, steeped in idolatry, falling hard and fast away from God. But then it started to turn around. Manasseh had started to turn them around, but had not taken the time to prepare his son to be king. And when Manasseh died, his son's heart was not with God. And he built all of the things that Manasseh had torn down, even though he had repented. He built them back up. And the people started sinning again, started worshiping the idols and started sacrificing to those idols. And it was only because Josiah, who, however he came out of this with a grandfather who was so evil and a father who was absolutely the same, how he came out of this to be somebody who was after God's own heart, I cannot tell you, because he did not learn it from his father or his grandfather. But he did learn. He learned, and he himself took it upon himself to start tearing down all of those high places, tearing down the idols, and having the priests, as we read in chapter 1, start cleaning up the temple. Money was taken from the temple to rebuild it, to turn it back into God's house. as they had remembered it, when it was in David and Solomon's hands. So Judah was sinful. Manasseh tried to turn it around, was unsuccessful. His son again was sinful and was killed. And Josiah finally started to turn it around. Josiah finally started to, as we read in the beginning here, in the eighth year of his reign, between the eighth and 12th year, did the very best he could to bring Jerusalem and Judah back to God, tearing down all of those sinful areas that had been erected. So, finishing this idea off, what did the Lord remember about Israel? This is the first question I posed to you, and this is going to be answered in the first three verses of this reading.
The Lord remembered the devotion of their youth, the love they had, betrothals, and they followed him in the wilderness.
Right. So what God remembered about Israel, about the United Nation, was that they were devoted to him, that they followed him, and that they were committed through a covenant to him. Now, of course, even at the time they were in the wilderness, God had to weed out some of that because there were those who would not follow him in the wilderness. And so that's why they spent 40 years in the wilderness. And it was 40 years in a land where they could not settle, where they could not grow, where they could not do for themselves, where they were wholly dependent on God to give them food and water, because there was nothing there. Nobody ever tried to live where they were living. That's why it wasn't settled. That's why there was nobody there, because it was just not possible for humans to live in that area. It was bereft of the things you would need to survive. And so what Judah was in the past was faithful to God. And Josiah was trying to turn the nation back to God. And Jeremiah was sent, was called, actually, to tell the people that they were failing, that their hearts were not with God, and that they were not turning back toward him. Oh, and the last thing there, they were holy to the Lord. Verse 3 of Jeremiah says, Israel was holy to the Lord, the first of his harvest. All who ate of it became guilty. Evil came upon them, declares the Lord. God considered Israel holy, sanctified, set apart from the rest. And that was what they meant to him. They were his bride. And Israel had committed adultery. So he gave them a writ of divorce and sent them away. And Judah now was committing adultery. And their end was going is heading to the same place that Israel's went, the northern 10 tribes. So in chapter 2, verses 4 through 8, we see that Judah rejected God. So my question to you was, who transgressed against Israel?
Rulers.
It starts by telling us that the priests, they did not seek after the Lord. The Levites, or those who knew the law, did not know the Lord. The rulers transgressed the Lord. And the prophets did not prophesy of the Lord, but of Baal. So what we have is Judah rejecting God, because we see that all of these four examples, people who were supposed to lead the people to God, were doing exactly the opposite. They were leading the people away from God. it wasn't an accident that these people had idols in their houses. When you see the priests and the rulers and the law keepers, or those who knew the law, and the prophets, those who are supposed to be telling you what is God's mind, when you see these people worshiping a God other than Yahweh, then what were the people to do? They had been led away. They had been led away into sin. And so who transgressed Israel? The ruling class of Israel transgressed Israel. And they led the people into sin. And so there were many of the people, as we know, as the story comes to a close, many years later, there was a remnant that stayed in the land, that those people knew God. There were some who stayed faithful, but they were few. Most of the Israelites, most of the Jews, even those who were living in the southern two tribes, either died or went into captivity because they transgressed the law that they had been given. As we continue in chapter 2, verses 9 through 13, this is charges against Israel, against the northern 10 tribes. So what two evils have the people of Israel committed against the Lord?
Forsaken God, who was the living water, for cisterns that they had made that broke and held no water.
Right. So they gave up a fountain of living waters, that is the Lord, who would keep them safe, who would provide for their every need, and decided to hew their own cisterns that were broken and unable to hold water. So the people rejected what God and the life he was willing to give them, to make their own way and to try to live without God, to try to live without him, to try to do for themselves. As we read in Judges, the people, even though they had a king, were still, even though they had a good king, were still doing whatever they wanted, whatever, wherever their heart led them. They had rejected God and all of the blessings that God had told them they would have if they stayed with him. Continuing through chapter 2, verses 14 through 19, this is their own wickedness will correct them. And so the question I asked you was, what would be the result of rejecting God and going after other worthless gods?
Ted, when I read this, in light of history, you know, they tried to make an agreement with the Assyrians because they thought the Assyrians would protect them. And in the long run, that turned out to be their undoing. They tried to make treaties with Egypt, but Egypt would attack them. So going after the worthless gods meant that they were really bringing it on themselves.
Correct. They were not in control of their own destiny anymore. They had become prey to the lions that were stalking about the land, to those Assyrians and those Egypts and those Palestinians, Philistines, to anybody who would invade their land, because they did not have the protection that God had been giving them. They did not have the power of God on their side. God had rejected them because they had given him up for other worthless gods. And so they were going to become slaves of other countries. And that's what I think verse 18 is talking about. But now what are you doing on the road to Egypt? To drink the waters of the Nile? Or what are you doing on the road to Assyria to drink the waters of the Euphrates? God asked him, why are you asking for help from your enemies? These are not people you should be making bargains with. You should not be paying these people money to protect you. I will protect you. But because you have drawn these people into your land, they are now going to become the lion that stalks the prey. And you have made yourselves vulnerable to these other countries that are going to destroy you. And we see that's exactly what happened to Israel. They were taken over by the countries that they had made agreements with and deals with. They had no way out of their sin except to turn to God, and they were hard-hearted and unwilling to do so. Egypt and Assyria have enslaved Israel, and now we see Egypt and Assyria are encroaching upon Judah. They're taking village by village, city by city. They were knocking on the door of Jerusalem. Only by God's hand did Jerusalem not fall the first time when Sennacherib came down. So it was foolishness for the people to decide that they wanted to try and do it on their own by making deals with the superpowers of the day rather than let God rule them. Dean, I don't have access to let anybody in right now because I'm using my screens, but looks like somebody's knocking on the door.
Got it.
Yep. And finally, leaving God and his protection will lead the Jews to coming back to God through the recognition of the result of their own sin. Once they get a taste of captivity, they won't like it. So the only way to correct their own wickedness is let their wickedness correct them. Because guaranteed, once they get a taste of Babylon, once they get a taste of Assyria, once they get a taste of Egypt and being a slave again, they won't like it. And they will cry to God for help. So that's exactly what God is going to do. Let their own wickedness correct them. He will stop protecting them. He will not be their king, and they will not be his people. And that's exactly what happened to Israel. So verses 20 through 28, they rejected God to follow idols. So these people were bowing down to these stone and hewn wood statues of the day as if these statues had brought them life. What type of vine had Judah become? In our reading in these nine verses, we see that Judah had become a particular type of vine, and what was it?
A degenerate vine.
Exactly. A degenerate shoots from a foreign vine. God did not recognize these people because these weren't from the vine of the fruit that he had planted. God had given them a law, had given them decrees, had given them the ability to live a life without sin and under his protection. And Judah was no longer the choice vine from the completely faithful seed that God had planted. They had chosen a different path. And so, like weeds growing into a garden, or like the yellow tulips you plant that come up red or purple the next year because they've been contaminated with different seed, with different fruit. It's the people of Israel first, and now the people of Judah were no longer recognizable as people of God. And as I've hinted at in some of our previous lessons, we're going to see that specifically, God says that it was the reign of Manasseh that changed his mind. His anger was so hot against what the people had allowed to happen in the land that there was nothing that was going to change his mind. We touched on it last week. Not even if Samuel or Moses had contested for the people, would God change his heart about what was going to eventually happen to Judah. What was the shame of Judah compared to?
A thief.
I'm sorry, one more time.
A thief.
A thief, exactly. A thief discovered in the act of robbery. We see it from time to time in the cartoons where you have the little bandit that's robbing the house, and then somebody turns the light on and the thief stands there, doesn't know what to do. And that's exactly what had happened to Judah. They had been sitting in the corners, in the high places. They had been worshiping idols. And God was shining a light on what they were doing. God was letting them know that that he would not allow this to happen to his people. And that he would not allow them to pollute the land the way they were. So we see Judah responds to this in a really weird way. So verses 29 through 37, Judah says, I'm innocent. So why did the Lord plead his case against Judah?
They wouldn't admit their wrongdoing.
Exactly. They would not soften their heart. Judah would not admit their guilt. They would not admit their sin. They would not admit their unrighteousness. Josiah was doing everything in his power for 5 years before Jeremiah was called by God. Josiah was doing everything he could to turn the people back around. But they would not admit that they were doing unrighteous things, that they were sinning, that they were polluting the land. They wouldn't admit it. And in our reading here, I think it's verse 35, he says, yet you said, I am innocent. Surely his anger is turned away from me. And God says, behold, I will enter into judgment with you because you said, I have not sinned. Sounds like the story of Job, except we know Job didn't sin. It was a trial for Job, but this is Judah worshiping idols, bowing down to trees and stones, saying, we haven't sinned. We didn't do anything. We are not in any way offending you. And the Lord said, yes, you are. And verse 36, he goes on to say, why do you go around so much changing your way? Also, you will be put to shame by Egypt as you were put to shame by Assyria. So this idea that they were sinless, Israel probably thought the same thing. But Israel was not sinless. They didn't have a good king ever after Jeroboam. And even Jeroboam wasn't a good king. Jeroboam dragged the northern 10 tribes into sin and unrighteousness, into idol worship, and even had a different place set for worshiping on altars that wasn't Jerusalem. And they never had a good king, and that's why they fell 100 years before, no longer than that, 200 years before Judah. Judah found themselves innocent in their own eyes, based on every man doing what his heart desired. They weren't doing anything wrong. They were doing what everybody else around them did. How is it wrong? How can it be wrong if so many people are doing it? And so Judah was innocent in their own eyes. But God here pleads his case against Judah, and he does it through Jeremiah. And we're going to see that as hard as Jeremiah tries, even he can't change the hearts of these people who are so corrupted that they will not return to God. So we start chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, looking at Judah's extreme harlotry. So how extensive was the harlotry in Judah? And we can find the answer to that in verse 1 of chapter 3.
God divorces.
Well, Judah was compared to a husband returning to a divorced wife who is already remarried. And how the Lord puts it is, will not the land be completely polluted? You cannot return to a wife whom you've divorced, let alone a wife who you have divorced who is now remarried to another man. You are committing a double sin. You are returning to a wife, which I told you not to do. But then again, you're committing adultery by returning to a wife who's already remarried. So this idea was abhorrent to God. This was a violation of two covenants, to divorce your wife and break one covenant, and then to commit adultery and cause another covenant to be broken. Absolutely abhorrent to God. And the land was polluted with harlotry and wickedness. And we use harlotry in a general broad term, not to say that everybody was prostitutes, but that these people were doing everything and anything they wanted to that was ungodly. They were falling away from God like a stone in a lake, heading to the bottom of the lake. They were so far from God that he could not see any redeemable qualities in them. There were the few, and God had found a good king in Josiah. And he tried his very best. But after the 55 years of his grandfather's reign and the 2 years of his father's reign, you can imagine 60 years of people worshiping idols. And that's become the norm. Think back 60 years from now. We're at 2020. Look back at 1960. Does that look like it's a long time away? What was happening 60 years ago? It does to me. I wasn't even born. Think about how much our nation has changed in 60 years. And for 60 years, not counting however long Manasseh changed his heart, but for 60 years, the people were doing everything they wanted that was absolutely ungodly. So the land was polluted with this harlotry and wickedness. And as a result, the curses God disclosed to the nation of Israel on Mount Ebal in Deuteronomy 27 had come to pass. There was nothing that these people could do to change this because they had violated the covenant. Through that covenant, they had blessings, and through that covenant, they had curses. And because they had violated the covenant and could not even recognize that they had violated the covenant, they found themselves innocent in their own eyes. These curses were descending upon them. Continuing into chapter 3, verses 6 through 11, the question I asked you there was, what had the Lord done to Israel because of her harlotries? So what had the Lord done to the northern 10 tribes because of her harlotries?
It says that God had given Israel a divorce.
Exactly.
And
in verse 8,
Judah didn't pay any attention.
Exactly. So the Lord had issued a writ of divorce as a result of her harlotry and as a warning to Judah. Judah, do you think Judah didn't see what had happened to the northern 10 tribes, to 85 or 90% of their land, of the people who lived there? Had Judah turned a blind eye to their fellow tribes and what was happening to them? Now, of course, the northern 10 tribes never had a good king, and the southern 2 tribes probably thought of them as lost anyway, because they weren't worshiping God the way they were supposed to, but they had gone down that, the northern 10 tribes had gone down that road, and Judah was skipping right along behind them. But they had seen what happened to the northern 10 tribes. They had seen what happened to Israel. They had seen what happens when God divorces you. The heinousness of what the Assyrians did to Israel, how they were led away in captivity, and we're not talking about in chains. I've heard stories of not just the killing and the raping and murdering that happened when Assyria came in, but how Jews were lined up with fish hooks put through their cheeks, and that's how they were walked back to Assyrians' land. They would never come back, at least not most of them, and they wouldn't be the same people. Judah went into captivity for 70 years. By that time, how long had these northern 10 tribes been in captivity for? Yeah. They went into captivity at 722. We're at 626 right now, so almost 100 years that those people have been out of the land. Two generations, three generations of people later. And they've been living in Assyria, in this land of sin and opulence, and there was no hope of finding any of the northern 10 tribes folks that knew God. Maybe very, very few. But the remnant out of the northern 10 tribes would be very, very small. Judah would spend 70 years in captivity to the Babylonians, but they would remember, there would be those living who went into captivity that would come back. There was nobody alive from Israel. No one. That writ of divorce that God gave Israel was a warning to Judah, and they ignored it. So the Lord watched as Assyria carried Israel away in captivity. He did nothing to stop them. In fact, the Lord gave Assyria the power to do so. He did not protect those northern 10 tribes in any way. They tried to protect themselves. They tried to make treaties. They tried to go to Israel or to Egypt. They tried to go to their enemies around and buy help. It would not help them. They were led away in captivity. And let's read this passage. Go to 2 Kings chapter 17. And I'm going to read you verses 7 through 18. And actually, we'll start at verse 6. So 2 Kings chapter 17, starting at verse 6. This is the end of Israel. This is what Judah would have seen. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and carried away Israel away into exile to Assyria and settled them in Halah and Habor on the river of Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. Now, this came about because of the sons of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up from the land of Egypt and under the hand of the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had feared other gods and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel and in the customs of the kings of Israel, which they had introduced. The sons of Israel did things secretly which were not right against the Lord their God. Moreover, they built themselves high places in all their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set for themselves sacred pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there they burned incense on all the high places, as the nations did which the Lord had carried away to exile before them. And they did evil things, provoking the Lord. They served idols, concerning which the Lord had said to them, "You shall not do this thing." Yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah through his prophets and every seer, saying, "Turn your evil ways and keep my commandments, my statutes, according to all the law which I commanded to your fathers and which I sent to you through my servants and prophets, my servants the prophets." However, they did not listen, but stiffened their neck like their fathers, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They rejected his statutes and his covenant, which he had made with their fathers, and they rejected his warnings, which he had warned them. And they followed vanity and became vain, and went after the nations which surrounded them, concerning which the Lord had commanded them not to do. They forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God, and made for themselves molten images, even two calves, and made an Asherah, and worshipped all the hosts of heaven, and served Baal. Then they made their sons and their daughters pass through the fire, and practiced divination and enchantments, and sold themselves to do the evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him. So the Lord was very angry with Israel, and removed them from his sight. None was left except the tribe of Judah. I don't know how more blatant the Lord could have been than what he did. He gave Judah one more chance. He gave them an example of what would happen if they continued in the way they were going, and they ignored it. As we go into chapter 3, verses 12 through 20, we see that there are promises of Israel and Judah are invited to repent and return. So from this, I ask you the question, in those days, what would Jerusalem be called? You'll find that in verse 17.
The throne of the Lord.
Absolutely. So Jerusalem would be the throne of the Lord. All nations would be gathered to it, and they will walk no more after the stubbornness of their evil heart. So that idea that Jerusalem would be the center, that the people would be able to come back to it. And the hint here that it's not just Israelites anymore, that all nations would be gathered to it. And so we have this, as we had touched on before, this hint, this idea that there is coming a time when other nations will be invited to worship God openly, where God will love to have them, and that people will choose not to walk after the stubbornness of their own heart, but choose to walk in righteous ways that God has set before them, and that Jerusalem will be called the throne of God. We touch on it here. We'll get into this a lot further as we get further into Jeremiah, where we'll see other references to other nations, to all nations being invited to partake at the table of the Lord. As we continue, you know what? I went the wrong direction. Hold on. Try this again. There we go. So as we continue in chapter 3, verses 21 through 25, we finish off the chapter looking at a prayer of repentance. So what is the salvation of Israel?
Remaining in the Lord.
Absolutely. Yep, in verse 23, it tells us, surely the Lord our God is the salvation of Israel. So you're going to find salvation in the Lord, and that's the only place you're going to find it. That's what we see here in this prayer. We see that you can look around, you can try and find it anywhere you want to look, but the only place you're going to find salvation is in the Lord. We see that even after generations of sinfulness and disobedience, the Lord is the salvation of Israel. And that will remain the same. That there is no other way to righteousness except through the Lord. And then finally, as we complete our study for tonight, chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. The question I ask is, what did the Lord say to the men of Judah? You can find it in verses 3 and verse 4.
Break up your fallow ground and do not sow among thorns.
Exactly. Circumcise yourselves to the Lord and remove the foreskins of your heart. The Lord is warning Judah that the wrath is coming if repentance is not forthcoming. These final four verses of our study tonight are probably as stark a warning as you'll get from the Lord. He starts in verse 1 saying, if you will return, then you should return to me. And if you will put away your detested things from my presence and will not waver, and you will swear as the Lord lives in truth, in justice, and in righteousness, then the nations will bless themselves in the Lord, and in the Lord they will glory. Your example, if you can turn from sinfulness to righteousness, is an example to everybody around you, and they will see it. He tells them that it's time to stop being lazy. It's time to start sowing the seed of righteousness. Break up your fallow ground. Don't try to sow a garden when it's overgrown with thorns. That won't work. You need to start with your own hearts. Break up that fallow ground and then start living righteous lives so that people around you can see it. Then it makes it so much easier to plant seed and watch it grow. Because if you can't change your heart, you have no hope of changing the heart of those around you. He tells them to circumcise the foreskins of their heart, to give up what you want, to give up those things that are easy, to do something that's hard, something that's difficult, something that's required of you that you won't like, but that is important. And he says, if you don't do these things, my wrath will be upon you. So we end our study tonight with a warning from God to Judah that you have one choice, and that is to turn your heart towards me. And if you don't do that, you have no hope whatsoever. So this is the beginning of the story of Judah, and Jeremiah is being shown and told to show that unless Judah turns from iniquity, they're going to suffer Israel's fate. They're going down the same road Israel went, and it's going to be just as bad for them, if not worse. Any questions or comments?
I thought of that too, how Ted could be a minister.
I'm teaching a class. It's all good.
Oh, we must be unmuted.
It's a serious thing, obeying God and staying with God.
Absolutely it is. It is a serious thing. Yeah. It's a serious thing for them. It's a serious thing for since the creation. And it's a serious thing for us today to make a choice to be a child of God. And when you make the choice, it's a serious thing as well to live your life in a way that brings people to God. That is to live in a life of it as an example that people want to make that choice. So we got to remember that this is a lesson that we can learn, as I think we all see in our land, just like generations before us have seen the evil and the unrighteousness that have ruled the land, we see it as well. I can't say that our generation is any worse than the generation that came before or the generation before that. But we do see the degradation. We see the falling away, and we see that it's important for us to remember that we have examples of what happens to nations that fall away from God, that turn their hearts on God, and that we need to live our lives shining that light. We're going to be part of the nation regardless of what happens to it, but we need to do our very best to be examples.
I think about Josiah, where it would apply to us, and I doubt very seriously whether he had any control over the country of Judah when he was 8 years old. He must have had some advisors that were faithful people, had a lot of influence on him. Perhaps even his mother may have been a faithful person and raised him accordingly. When his father must have been about 14 or 15 years old when he was born. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense there, but who knows? There may have been a few years in there where other people actually controlled the purse strings. But I think it was important to note that Josiah must have had faithful advisors that advised him as he was coming up through those young years. Leads us to believe that we need to be advisors to our children, to others around us, an important thing. I think, too, it brings back Emerson Flannery long, many years ago. I remember Emerson saying one time that during the reign of Hezekiah, Manasseh's father, Hezekiah being a faithful king, but he was sick. The Babylonians sent messengers to him asking about his welfare, and he showed them all of his goodies and didn't hold anything back. He said, because you did that, the Babylonians are going to take them away from you. And they did several hundred years later.
Yep.
They came back and got it all. And so maybe this was foretelling some of the tragedies that was going to happen to Judah, even during Hezekiah's time.
Right. And part of the reading that we looked at tonight, and the reason I wanted to look at it, is because was that reading about Ammon that Mark read. And that Ammon, Josiah's father, only served 2 years as a king because his servants killed him.
Yeah.
There was righteous people there that recognized the evil of the land. And when they saw after Manasseh had turned over a leaf and it started to destroy all the sin that was in the land, when they saw Ammon bringing it back, they took him out. They didn't want to go back down that road. There were still righteous people in the land. And so I think you're right. I think the people that were living in the palace at that time in Jerusalem that were part of the royal entourage, many of them were still faithful to God and recognized the evil that was coming. And so I think Josiah did have some good examples around about him.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't know the book of the law any more than anybody else until Hilkiah, assumedly Jeremiah's father, sent him the book of the law, and it was read before him. So he knew righteousness. He knew what God wanted, but he didn't know every jot and tittle of the law. That wasn't until after he had read the law and probably the blessings and cursings that were recorded in the law that he understood how dire their situation was.
Yeah.
Any other comments or questions?
Thank Good you. Lesson tonight.
Those who killed Ammon were killed themselves by the people of the land. You know, Dean knows about this psychology stuff. The heart of Josiah was good. See how the heart of Manasseh changed when he was afflicted. Sure, he was humiliated and afflicted, but he also had a heart to change from his vile evilness back to righteousness. Something may be hereditary in there that Josiah inherited.
Maybe. Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't have seen what happened with his grandfather, but he would have known about it. And well, maybe he'd have seen it. What? He would have been, because Ammon only reigned 2 years, and Josiah was 8 when he took over, so he would have been 6 when Ammon started his reign, and so he would have seen the end of Manasseh's reign, and he would have seen the goodness of Manasseh's reign, and maybe that had a huge impact on him. Maybe because Josiah saw Manasseh after he had come back from Assyria and had heard the stories of being in captivity and had known what that would be about. Maybe it put a fear of God into him that would not be quenched. I don't know. But I can imagine being a 4 or 5, 6 year old hearing stories from your grandfather about how horrible he was treated and how scary it was to be without God. But that would have a huge impact on a child.
Well, I think about people who grow up with alcoholic fathers. Sometimes they turn so completely anti-alcohol that they just, they're rabid in their vehemence of about no alcohol at all. And then another child grows up with an alcoholic father and turns into an alcoholic because of what he's seen in his father. So I think Israel was, or Judah was, fortunate that Josiah decided he wasn't going to have anything to do at all with the things that got his grandfather into trouble.
Agreed. Yep, I think it had a huge impact on him. And had it only had a bigger impact on his father, maybe it would have saved his life too. But Ammon was too far gone. He had grown up probably, I'd have to read in Kings, I don't know exactly when Manasseh was hauled away by the Assyrians, but obviously Ammon had been tainted by how Manasseh had worshipped the idols and the Asherim and the sacrificing of his own children, passing them through the fire. Those things had a huge impact on Ammon, and his heart couldn't be changed.
Yeah, and the courtesans who had eventually killed Ammon probably had a great deal to do with the early years of Josiah. We know that they were in the court and in a position where they could assassinate Ammon. So thankfully they were the ones who had something to do with bringing up Josiah.
But as Carl had pointed out, verse 25 of that reading says, but the people of the land killed all of the conspirators against King Ammon, and the people of the land made Josiah his son king in his place. Why they killed those conspirators, I don't know. Maybe they wanted to go back to the idol worship. Maybe that could very well be the case, that's what they were expecting to get out of Josiah, but then all of a sudden they found he was a righteous king. They had put a king in place who was trying to bring them back closer to God. Who knows? But all we know is that it was fortunate for Judah that Josiah had somebody teaching him about God, because his heart was aimed at God, and then he wanted to do every. Go ahead.
You gotta remember that the Lord turned his back upon Judah because of his grandfather, and right. Nothing was going to change his mind.
No. Yeah, nothing's going to change his mind. We see a lot in this message of Jeremiah about repentance and coming back to righteousness and living with God. And I think that gives us an idea that
we're seeing what happened with the kings, but the people of the land were just not turning their hearts towards
God. No, I'm just teaching a class.
So it was one of those things where you don't get the whole picture. It's not all recorded, but you can read between the lines and see that the people of Israel had given up on God. The people of Judah had given up on God. All right. Barring any email issues, I'll have the outline for you probably middle of next week instead of on Saturday or Sunday morning, so that you guys have a little more time to look at it.